Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night, we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast, and around the world on the BBS Radio Network, if I have a voice.
Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone.
Our guest, Dr. Norman Rosenthal, M.D., he is the author of Transcendence, Healing, and Transformation Through Transcendental Meditation. He's a clinical professor of psychiatry at Georgetown Medical School and has maintained a private practice in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area for nearly 30 years now. He's conducted research at the National Institute of Mental Health as a research fellow, researcher, and senior researcher for over 20 years. And let us say, Norman, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And thank you so much for being here. Transcendence, we're talking about transcendental meditation. Let's lay a base of what, a practical base of what transcendental meditation is, and then we can work from there.
It's a simple technique that involves sitting down twice a day for 20 minutes, closing your eyes, making yourself comfortable, and then working with a mantra, or shall I say just thinking a mantra, mm-hmm. that has been given to you by a teacher, and shown, you're shown kind of how to use that mantra in a way that has the desired effect, which we can talk about in a moment. So those are the elements that are key to the practice.
Okay, that's the dynamic, but the end result, and what I understand, stop me if I'm wrong, I'm not a clinician, but when we're dealing with transcendental meditation, we're talking about somebody gaining the ability to become mindful for that moment that they're doing it, or moments that they're doing it, they're fully and totally concentrated. They've got homeostasis. They've got balance, which normally through the day, we don't have that. We have stress. We have other factors that cause us to be healthy, to be sick, to be whatever the case may be. But being able to center for whatever time that you can allows you to become mindful and to let the body and all the mechanisms of the body do what they're supposed to do.
You know, I would use slightly different words, and it's not really just semantic. Rather than saying mindful, I would say it helps you transcend. Why do I say that as a difference? Because there is a whole branch of meditation called mindfulness, whereby you really focused on what's going on in the moment, whether it's your breathing or your thoughts or whatever. This is very different. The mantra comes in a very automatic way once you get the hang of it. And what that does, it's almost like a diving bell that takes you down into a different state of consciousness, which is called transcendence, which is why I called the book Transcendence. And what that state does is it allows you to access a very joyful and pleasurable state within the self. At the same time, it lets all the systems of the body relax. Blood pressure drops, breathing slows down, and the effects of these 20 minutes twice a day carry on through the rest of the day, influencing all your feelings and your physiological systems.
But moving through this, and this is a question now, moving through this, we go through life with mechanisms. We go through life with chemicals that are triggered based on an emotion, based on an experience, etc. And to get to this particular place that you're talking about, at that stage, when you talk about joyfulness, etc., at that stage, aren't we in a position whereby if the body is calm, those defense mechanisms aren't there and you're not going through any kind of a pressure. So you go beyond that quote-unquote fight or flight mechanism.
Definitely. That is absolutely right. The fight or flight mechanisms are stilled. They're settled down. And these, of course, in our modern world, are mechanisms that grind on relentlessly sometimes. And we see it in people who are working too hard or people who are under all kinds of different pressures. It's so common. And then we also see it in special groups like veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder and other people. But you don't have to look to special groups. Everybody or many people are under stress. If I talk to an audience and I say, put up your hands, who's under stress on a daily basis? Hardly a hand doesn't go up because we're all feeling it lots of the time, and it really is a fantastic stress relief mechanism for settling this down.
Now, let's take it even to a more simpler basis. You're standing in the house. Your wife says to you, did you take the garbage out? Is it a question or is it an accusation? If you take it as a question, there's no mechanism. If you take it as an accusation, the entire mechanism kicks up and you've got stress going. We automatically defend and it's unconscious and we're not even aware of it, Norman.
That's so true. I mean, you could think, she's always bugging me. Nothing I ever do is enough. So you could escalate it very easily. Or you could say, you know, she wants to know if I took the garbage out. And,
you know,
be very calm about it. Well, what I find with people, once they start to do transcendental meditation, they're much more likely to do the second one. I use as a common example being cut off in traffic. Quite an irritating thing, and I don't think anybody likes being cut off in traffic. But, you know, I've seen people swearing at the other driver and making gestures and whatever, and you can imagine that's not very good for one's nervous system. You know, somebody who's meditating is much more likely to say, you know, maybe that person has a problem, but why should I let it become my problem?
And by the way, what we're really dealing with in most people today, with the stress that is going on with the economy, the downturn, the lack of jobs, and this list goes on, and the apathetic condition that we've gotten ourselves into because of not taking a stand of what's going on politically, you look at all of these factors and you throw them into the mix, no wonder somebody is stressful. But at the same time, if you use a process like you're talking about, it allows you to calm down, allows you to get it back together again, and not have to jump at something. You can sit back, take it in, and then you have, quote unquote, you have choice of how you're going to feel about it.
Right, it's true. Yeah. And I do want to say, you know, I'm a scientist, but I'm also a meditator. I was at the National Institute of Health for 20 years. And I actually did a lot of original work myself. I described the syndrome called seasonal affective disorder, and I developed the treatment of light therapy. That was my original work. And I simply say it by way of saying, you know, I'm not somebody who's going to jump on every fad that comes along.
Sure.
I examined this area, and I decided that this is really something worth telling people about. I know it personally because I would never recommend anything that I didn't, you know, person like this that I didn't personally try and find actually that was very transformative in my own life and in my patients' lives. But I've examined the research data, and there really are some extraordinary facts that are worth just knowing about. For example, that it reduces blood pressure, it reduces cardiovascular disease, and now in two studies, it actually prolongs life, which is pretty unbelievable when you think about it.
No, absolutely. Well, I can imagine if the stress is eliminated, it allows your immune system to work. Most of us have a lot of stress, and because of that stress, it affects the immune system, and we know what can happen there. So if you're calming down, if you're centered, it allows the immune system to kick in and effectively do the job. And by the way, the SAD that you were just talking about, I spent 24 years in Fairbanks, Alaska, where we had dark. What was it, 7-8 months out of the year? So I actually saw cases of that.
I'm sorry, I missed that.
I said that with the sad, I said I lived in Fairbanks, Alaska, the interior, for about 23, 24 years. So I actually saw cases of the problem with not getting enough sunlight and not enough light.
Yes, yes. It can really be quite serious. So, you know, I'm glad you've seen it in your own life.
Now, by the way, when we talk about meditation, how does one start? You know, and one of the things when I say how does one start, when the majority of people think of meditation, they're thinking of you're sitting 3 feet off the ground and you're meditating and you hear what I'm saying. And that's not really what it is. It's a science. How do you get somebody to really look at it in the light that it really is as opposed to what it's been, the mask that it's worn?
Right. Well, this particular brand of meditation, transcendental meditation, it's a little bit like yoga or karate. You have to go and find a guide, a teacher, somebody who is credentialed to teach it, because it is like one of those skills that even though once you get the hang of it, it's pretty simple. Somebody needs to teach you. You can't get, you know, $10 book and then learn it out of the book like you couldn't do with golf or tennis or any of these, you know, evolved skills. So you find a good teacher. You can do that. My book lists resources. By all means, you can check out the TM organization or the David Lynch Foundation or my website, which is normanrosenthal.com. All of these will lead you to available resources. But the reason that I wrote the book is that, you know, 20 minutes twice a day in a modern life, that's a lot to ask of somebody. And I know for myself that before I would devote that amount of time, I would need to be really and truly persuaded that it was absolutely worth it. And that's what my book lays out. It lays out a rationale for why somebody would really benefit and enjoy that time. Because, you know, oftentimes, Wordsworth many years ago said, the world is too much with us. And if it was true then, heavens, is it true now with the internet and all the plugins that we have to the communication networks? And so this is an opportunity to have some quiet time in the course of the day to practice a technique that's going to restore and regenerate you. And, you know, like I have a day of patience, an afternoon of patience. I sit down 20 minutes later. It's as though your windshield has been wiped clean and the world looks fresh and clear again. It's quite extraordinary, actually.
I think we're getting to a point whereby we're realizing more and more that the brain is an electrochemical factory, and the chemicals in and of themselves are going to determine and dictate how you are going to be through the day and how you're going to be through your life, physically, emotionally, intellectually, you name it. It's going to be caused by some kind of a chemical. What I'm hearing you say is when you calm down, you put everything in order and they're doing what they're supposed to do, and you're not triggering those that are going to, quote unquote, protect you and cause stress and cause problems in your life. It's controlling.
Absolutely. You know, there's much talk about a, quote, happiness set point, the idea that all of us have got our level of happiness and that no matter what we do, that we're going to come back to that point. I don't believe that. I believe we can raise whatever biology has given us. We can make the most of it. And one way to do it is to conserve our chemicals. So I think that you're absolutely right. It is a very complicated chemical, electrical, to call it a machine almost doesn't do it justice because it's such an intricate work of art. But I think we can boost those processes and feel better. Also, I want to mention to you that although you're calm, you're not calm like a zombie. You know, you're calm and energized at the same time. It's a wonderful mix of being, not being anxious, but being very alert and alive. It's a lovely combination that goes into transcendence, which incidentally, once you are meditating regularly, spills over into the everyday life and gives you the enjoyment and the benefit throughout the day.
And by the way, I think that when we talk about the chemicals, dopamine, that's the chemical that fuels the brain's pleasure center. And a smile will release the dopamine or endorphins, And laughter, they say, is the best medicine. What actually happens is when your brain releases that, it's a dopamine squirt. And you feel better, you calm down. And it's very interesting. If somebody were angry, if you just took the moment and smiled, forced yourself to laugh, that's actually controlling the chemistry that goes through your brain that affects your emotions in your body. So once you've got a handle on it, and I really believe to get a handle on it, you've got to do what you're talking about, the transcendence, to get into that space whereby you know what you're doing, you can control the way the mechanisms of your body work, and you can control the way you feel.
Well, you've just said it better than I could. I agree with absolutely everything you say.
And then, by the way, but it's a so, and I think that's really what it boils down to be. You can't control. You can't control somebody from walking up and slapping you in the face, quote unquote. But you can control the way you feel about it and your response and your reactions to it. And I think that's really at base of what we're talking about here today.
Yes, yes. And, you know, when you find something that's really wonderful, like, I mean, on the simplest level, when you find a restaurant that you just think is marvelous, you want to tell everybody about that restaurant. You want all your friends to go and enjoy it. And that's sort of how I felt with discovering the technique. You know, you can discover things in many ways. And when I say discovered it, I discovered it for myself. Obviously, it had been discovered many years ago, but when I stumbled across it, and I describe in the book how I stumbled across it, and when I felt the personal benefits and saw the benefits in my patients, that then inspired me with a kind of passion that said, let me explain it to other people. Now, you know, when you're passionately trying to encourage other people to do something, it's very common for people to feel, wait a sec, what's this guy selling me, you know? It's very, we're a skeptical culture, and we should be, because there are lots of people selling us something all the time. So we should be skeptical. But what I've found is that when you've got a book that you can take into the privacy of your own space, read it in your own time, read it however you want to do it, that's when you have the chance to really think about something and determine, is this interesting? Is this right for me? That's what I'm so happy to be able to present with this particular book.
Norman, we're just about out of time. And by the way, the book in and of itself, I've got the book in my hand, and it's forwarded by Dr. Oz, quote unquote. Now, is there a website we can find you at and buy the book?
Absolutely. You can find me on normanrosenthal.com, and it's very simple to order the book through that website.
Wonderful.
And it's just my name, normanrosenthal.com. By all means, if your listeners would like to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Dr. Norman, D-O-C-T-O-R, Norman. Join me over there. I'm constantly updating people with the new developments and new events and exciting things that are going on. There's a kind of a buzz out there, and I'm just so happy to be a part of it, because it's a buzz that's spreading positive, good things to make people feel healthier and happier.
Norm, thank you so much for being with us. I've appreciated your time. Good work, and the book is great. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a joy. Take care. Bye-bye.
Good night.
And desert oasis, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Russell Skull with us, corporate executive chef from Fleming's, Fleming's Steak Prime House. I got it backwards. Prime, she even hit me when I said that. Prime Steakhouse and Wine Bar. Russell, hi. Welcome to the show.
Oh, welcome. You know what? I mix it up sometimes too, so.
By the way, backwards is great. Then it gives me the entire show to get it right. By the way,
there corporate you go.
Executive chef, thanks for having me on.
I appreciate it.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. Because, you know, I can go through your bio, which I was going to go through. But the key here is we are really dealing with something that is a special gift for fathers on Father's Day. You take them for the greatest meal that they've ever had, and all of a sudden you got a dad who appreciates you. Because I'm looking at the menu now, and we are talking about filet mignon, New York strip sirloin, ribeye steak, porterhouse steaks. And what more could you ask for a gift on Father's Day for a father?
Oh, it's pretty good, I tell you, but you have to throw that prime rib in there.
Oh,
that's
by the way,
phenomenal
absolutely.
Deal, and I tell you, the father, it's been a big hit every year since we've had it on.
Now, let me ask you this. When we talk about steaks, you know, you can go to a place and order a steak, but a steak just isn't a steak, is it?
No, it's not. Obviously, when you said prime steakhouse, prime connotates the best of the beef out there. About 2% of all beef available is prime, and the majority of it's choice. What that means is when you come into Fleming's or a place like that has prime beef, it's going to be guaranteed pretty much a very, very good quality cut of steak. But then it all comes down to how you cook it, right?
Sure. Now, Russell, it's very important when somebody becomes a corporate executive chef, that's critical because you take a look at everything that goes through there. You oversee the menu development, supervision of the kitchen staff, and the purchase of food products for the restaurants, and that list goes on. It takes that expertise of knowing what you're doing to look over everybody's shoulder to say, in the end result, when we put this food on the table, it better be what the customer wants, and it better look as good as it tastes.
Well, you got that down pretty good. You must have worked in the restaurant industry for a while, or at one point. It does. Just like any job, I guess, when you supervise, you've got to be on top of it all the time. It's 24/7, but I tell you, it's a labor of love. I've been doing it since, as you look at my bio there, since I grew up in the family business. So it's something I definitely enjoy. And I guess when you do something you enjoy, it's not really like work. It's kind of like fun every day.
No, no question about it. But I've got my own definition of a chef. I've watched for years. I've gone into kitchens. I've talked to chefs. And a chef is like an artist. It's not just throw something on a plate and deliver it. It's like putting it up on a canvas, and you put this ingredient in that and that ingredient, this color, that color. You shape it, you form it, you mold it. And then by the time it hits that table, it is like a portrait. If it's not, then you can't really charge a price for it, and people really don't come back in. They not only come in for taste, but they come in for the ambience and all of those things that surround it that cause them to keep coming back over and over and over.
That's exactly right. It's really about the total experience, and our job every day is to garner one more guest to not only come in the restaurant, but to make a return visit. And it's the ambiance, as you mentioned, but people eat with their eyes. And if they come into a place that's warm and welcoming, and one of the things we always say in our restaurant is that it's kind of like we're throwing a party at our house. So if you think about throwing a party at your house, you invite all your friends in. That's how we consider it, and we treat the guests that come in, like friends and family that come in and try to basically throw a party. Each server tries to throw a party at each one of those individual tables, which in itself can be a daunting task.
Oh, no question about it. And I think one of the problems that the challenge is not a problem that you guys face. I'm going to take you back 100 years when when you got a hamburger, you got a steak, etc. It tasted different than the steaks do today. They didn't have all of those, all the steroids and all of the antibiotics and all of the things that they feed the cattle before they get prepped for the dinner table, quote unquote. So there was a freshness that was there that it's very hard to recapture. And I can imagine that it's got to be a little bit tough to be able to filter through to make sure that that customer coming in is going to get the absolute best.
Well, and that's a very good statement, because not only is it 24/7 in the restaurant making sure the guests get the food, it's the procurement of that food every single day. As a world, we just consume a lot of different food items, whether it's from the sea, the land, farms with produce, and as you said, antibiotics and chemicals. And they do that to preserve, not to help the plants and the things grow. So we can have those items available for us. But it does, as the item itself changes, and if you want to talk about beef, we got to come up with better ways of making that beef still taste as great as it did, back, as you said, 100 years ago. And I remember my father's restaurant being a steakhouse, how great, as a young kid, remember how great that meat did taste as it does today.
Now, by the Fleming's Prime Steakhouse in Wine Bar. Now, I know that you're on Bluemont Road. I know you're in Brookfield. I'm not that far away from you physically, but you guys are all over the country, aren't you?
We have 64 locations. It's interesting you mentioned that. I was just in Brookfield. I was at the NRA, which you know about, and it was a couple weeks ago, and I stopped at that restaurant to work with the chef there a little bit, see how he was doing. And, yeah, it's a great, but 64 locations, I believe, in 22, 23 states across the country.
Now, by the way, I think the hardest thing that anybody would have to do when you've got a chain is to make sure that every restaurant, if you walk into one, no matter where you are in the country, when you walk into another one, it's like walking into the same door, into the same place. That, I think, is the key to success when you're branding yourself as a restaurant.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. It does take a lot of work, the training process of training all the new associates in a restaurant. And that's one of the things, too, as I mentioned the word associate. We talk about the people that work for us as associates versus employees. And, we have a restaurant. We don't consider ourselves a chain restaurant, but multiple units across the country. And we try to allow them to personalize it within the four walls so that it's kind of that neighborhood steakhouse. And hopefully you can see that when you walk into that Brookfield restaurant.
That's the one thing that we're missing today. Way back when there was the quote-unquote the mom and pops. You walked in, they knew your name, they knew the name of your dog, they knew your family, and pretty much everything about you. There was a friendliness, and it wasn't a number that somebody was wearing, across the counter or serving food. It takes that personal touch. Not only does the food have to be of a certain quality and caliber, so do the people that work there, and that's what's going to bring somebody in. Once they get in, obviously, it's the food that's going to get them. But to get them to that point, to be able to walk in and feel comfortable where you are.
Oh, very much so. And it's an experience that how often is a guest going to go out to a restaurant, especially a place like Fleming's, and is it once every 2-3 months or so? And they're going to spend some money there, and special occasion, type of a atmosphere, whether it's an anniversary, birthday, or just they're celebrating some kind of a promotion or graduation, and they're going to come in and. That you have one opportunity. We always say there's one opportunity to make a first grade impression, and we have to hit on all 8 cylinders each and every time they come in. And I think it goes back to the training, as you mentioned earlier, bringing in the best food items, serving the best food items, cooking them correctly, and then the service end of making sure that the guest is completely 100% satisfied before they walk out of that restaurant.
And also, you've got to be able to get on a talk show where the host doesn't blow the intro.
I think we got by that one already.
Okay, playing with that one. But when we really come down to it, I really believe if you did a focus group and if you asked 15 or 20 people what it was that they really enjoyed about Fleming's and really got into it, what do you think that the common denominator would be, that overarching theme that would cause them to come back? What would it be?
Well, we've actually done those focus groups, and when you look at the high-end steakhouse where we are, Fleming's, and there's other concepts out there very similar, it comes down to everything you've been talking about. It's that personal touch. It's that they feel special. it's kind of that Cheers atmosphere where everyone knows your name, that they feel like they're in their neighborhood steakhouse. And I have guests that I've met in the times that I travel, and as you know, we have 64 restaurants. I am across the country, east to west, north to south, in those restaurants. I probably travel 200-plus days out of the year to get to those restaurants, and I meet people on the road. I always travel. They can tell I'm with Fleming's, and I have guests that have been probably in just about half of our restaurants, not a lot of those people, but they say it's pretty consistent, and they really make you feel special. But you know what? They also let me know when it's not quite right, and we appreciate the feedback that we get because we take that very seriously, and our president does a great job with making sure that we respond very quickly, you know, within 2-3 hours of a guest complaint, to make sure they know that we think it's important, that their comments are important. Obviously, we can't do everything they ask us to do, but the fact that we listen to them, I think that makes people feel really special.
Yeah, Russell, you've worked at the Ritz-Carlton in Dana Point, California, which I've been to that, Arizona-based Sullivan Steakhouses. You've been around a long time in different places. What is it about Fleming's that really drew you there?
It's, I think our parent company is a great company. Outback Steakhouse is our parent company. So we're part of a larger group, but they let Fleming's be Fleming's. And Fleming's was started 12 years ago from Bill Allen and Paul Fleming. And people know Paul Fleming with the P.F. Chang's. It really is, it started out and still is today, that family kind of atmosphere where it was a small group that started this concept. We have pretty much the same core group. When you talk about the president and the vice president and myself and as a corporate chef, the director of training, our wine director, everybody has been around for such a long time. We're kind of all on the same page, and it's really all about top quality. We bring in top quality, especially when you talked about the high-end steaks. We didn't talk about the fact that you got 100 wines by the glass that change on a regular basis to make sure our guests are getting something new and exciting. We feel part of our job is to educate the guests when they come in by serving unique food, when the chef's creating special chef's features for them, bringing in new and exciting items. So I think just really to answer your question, a couple more words here is that it's offering the best. It is a great company to work for, and watching people's faces when they come in and they enjoy the restaurant.
Really, one of the things that I was looking for and what I want to say now, what was it about Fleming's that caused you to be there? When you're an executive chef, you're not standing in line for a job someplace. You're sought after. So you guys, if you get the top of the line where you are in the industry at that level, they come after you for the most part. And to be at a particular restaurant is to say something in and of itself for the restaurant.
I'm not sure, Michael, what your question is there?
No, it wasn't. It was a statement.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
No, I agree. Yeah. There aren't that many corporate executive chefs in major companies like this across the country, so I feel very privileged to have this opportunity to be here. It's as I said earlier, it's enjoyable. My father taught me that he never worked a day in his life. You just go do something you enjoy every day, and that's what I do. And if you look at a lot of the chefs that, especially in all these cooking programs, they really do enjoy what they do. And you can be as creative as you want to be. And the fun thing is, if you're starting to make an dish and doesn't quite turn out the way you wanted it to be, you call it something else and you just kind of go a different direction. And you got to be flexible.
Yeah.
A little bit thick-skinned because you have food critics out there and not everything you make, they're going to enjoy.
Now, by the way, you got your average food critic coming in, and there's no question about that. But what about the professionals who come in, who sit down and do a write-up on the restaurant? What kind of reaction have you guys gotten?
Well, we've gotten some very good press write-ups in the different cities we've been in, especially right after we open up. One of the things they've always talked about is, wow, I can't believe you've only been open 4 or 5 days or even a couple of weeks, how efficient the service is, the knowledge that the staff has on all of the food items that we do serve, whether it's 100 wines by the glass, or if they have some questions about the type of steak, the prime beef and choice beef, and how we season our food. I've got a lot of my fellow chef buddies out there that come in the restaurant. They can be a little harsh, and then I kind of get them back a little bit as well. But we kind of strive off that feedback. If you don't make mistakes, you can't really move forward and improve. So you got to get that feedback, and you got to, as I said earlier, be thick-skinned, listen to it, kind of absorb it a little bit and move forward and improve upon it.
Okay, Father's Day is coming up. Any specials for anybody listening?
Oh, yeah. Well, we talked about that prime rib. Prime rib we have every Sunday, but we actually started earlier in the day. Our brunch starts about 11:30. We have five different entrees on that special brunch menu, a couple different frittatas, and a delicious filet mignon benedict where we slice that off the whole tenderloin. And we use a buttermilk biscuit versus English muffins, a little bit different there. And then we also have a traditional smoked salmon and bagel for that, you know, the person that does want a kind of a heavy meal, they can kind of go light that way. And then we also offer a couple different things for the kids. But that's a package deal for everybody. That's $32.95 across the country.
Now, by the way, do you have a website we can find you at?
Oh, yeah, for myself or for the restaurants?
Both.
Oh, yeah, just FlemingsSteakhouse.com. And when you bring that up, Fleming's will pop up. And then when you get the main website, you can click on locations and then pick on any location that you want.
Got it. Now, Russell, we're just about out of time. Hey, listen, thanks a lot for coming on. I've appreciated the time with you.
Oh, thank you so much, Michael. I appreciate it.
Take care. Good night.
Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye. I can only give you love that lasts forever and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, from now and evermore. That's all. That's all. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Michael Fiore with us. He's the co-founder of Office Max. Here we go. In 1988, started with one store, won $20,000 of his own money, a partner in a small group of investors, and a CEO. He grew it to more than 1,000 stores worldwide with annual sales topping $5 billion. He's also the CEO of Max Ventures, a venture capital and retail consulting firm, and founder and CEO of Max Wellness, a comprehensive health and wellness retail chain that launched in 2010 after opening the initial laboratory test stores in Florida and Ohio, and a national rollout is now underway, and is the author of The Benevolent Dictators, Empower Your Employees, Build Your Business, and Outwit the Competition. Michael, hey, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. It's my pleasure.
Oh, by the way, thank you so much for being here. You know, when we're dealing with employees, that is an art. It's not just something that happens. It's an absolute art, and I have felt for the longest time now that if a person's going to be successful in business, it's got to come from the inside out. There was a time we thought differently, but with the economy, with the culture and the society, we have to think differently. And that thinking differently is dealing with employees. But there's a time when you're going to have to be, quote unquote, the dictator. You got to know when to roll them and when to fold them.
Well, I think the real thing, in terms of the book, The Benevolent Dictator, is really the emphasis is on the word benevolent, to the extent that as the CEO of a company, president, general manager, or the head of the popsicle stand, you need to do what is needed to be done for the greater good, with a focus on first the customer, then the employees, and then your other stakeholders. The dictator part basically means, and one of the biggest problems in business today is to move from mind to market. It sometimes has to be done as measured in days and weeks, not months and years as it was in the past. So when the time for talking is done and it's time to start doing, it is very difficult anytime you get more than three people in a room to get people to move to yes, and that's where the dictator portion comes in. The real trick, though, as I explain in my book, The Benevolent Dictator, is that a really good benevolent dictator really can do it by making the people think it is their idea. That's the ultimate way to get things done. But the dictator portion, as it refers to in the book, is knowing the techniques one must employ to get to that yes. One of my favorite all-time advertising theme lines is from Nike, "Just Do It." And that is very much what happens in business. Sometimes you just have to do it, have plan A, but certainly be prepared with plan B to maneuver as you work through the hurdles.
Now, by the way, when you first began Office Max, there was obviously a certain style of leadership that you had to have. Then it began to grow. Now, as you grow, does the style stay constant, or does the style change? Does it increase?
Good question. To be very honest to you, and certainly to you, all of your listeners, I am one of the luckiest people they'll probably ever hear from, because what I know today and what I didn't know in 1988, I must have been in the right place at the right time with the stars, moon lining up, because it's miraculous I was able to maneuver through everything because I didn't really know what I didn't know. Today, I think over the years of running Office Max and my career is in other things and as a writer for 8 years for a syndicated business column, you learn to fine-tune your style and your skills. And I'm a great believer in laboratories. And a laboratory every day is when you get out of bed and you go do what you do, whether it's your radio show or your viewer's ice cream store. You have to learn as you go. When you stop learning, you're in a lot of trouble. So the style specifically has changed radically. Some of the intuitive gut aspects of it haven't changed, but I have fine-tuned what needs to get done. And in the book, The Benevolent Dictator, I try to outline for readers in a hopefully entertaining, very readable fashion how to get from point A to point Z with as few casualties and as little pain and suffering as possible, and most importantly, enjoy the journey.
By the way, to get there is an interesting journey, the pain and the challenges that you go through. The key is if somebody had somebody looking over their shoulder, pointed out what you didn't see, brought that invisible up to the table to be able to work with it, most businesses wouldn't fail when they fail. So you get a book like you've got, it's the roadmap, it's hitting that restart button or refresh button to be able to take a look at it and to move forward. I think one of the biggest problems that we have today with employees is in the old days, the definition of an employee, their job was to do what the boss tells them to do, within reason, obviously. Today, sure. It doesn't work that way. Today, you don't have to come in at 9 and leave at 5 o'clock. You can sit out on the beach with your BlackBerry and get a lot of work done. So it's a different world and it's a different challenge today. And those people who are running it at the top have got to learn and have got to reevaluate.
Absolutely, you're 100% right. I used to joke in speeches all the time. I loved Office Max except for three constituents, the customers, the employees, and the shareholders. Other than that, I had a wonderful time every day of the week. The truth is, when you run a business, you sometimes don't get to make all of the rules because the rules are around you as the way people want to live their lives. So a good leader learns to adapt to the rules and make them work for her or him, so that they can reach their objectives. Business is accomplishing objectives through others, and without the other people, you're destined not to get very far. So the real key is understanding the underlying factors that motivate people, and every one of us has a different motivation at a given point in time. The old story, do you work to live or live to work? My answer is it depends on the point in your life. And there's a lot of different hot buttons. A really good entrepreneur, in my opinion, has to be a combination actor because they can't say what they really mean all the time, so they have to be able to present an idea in an effective manner to motivate others. They also sometimes have to bite their tongue. And you got to choose when and where to fight a battle. That's one of the big mistakes entrepreneurs make. And I think
that's
important lessons in the book, The Benevolent Dictator, spell out exactly when and how to do these things. Everything from, I know there's a chapter, I think it's 29 or 30, how to deal with prima donnas that you can't live with and you can't live without. So if it's more costly to get rid of them, you better learn to live with them. And the way to do that is learn how to motivate them and make it work.
By the way, no question, what I would love to see is someone with your experience, you take this book and you put it right into the administration, current, prior, or those that are going to be ahead of it. One of the big problems that we have in the world today, as far as government goes, the government has turned into a business, Michael, and they're not dealing with it like a business. If you took the same exact principles you're talking about right now.
I think we should make that a mandatory requirement of all politicians. I think we can't get the deficit fixed. I doubt if we could get them to agree to anything like that, but it's a good idea.
No, see, what you're saying is stay on track. What we're dealing with now, and I'm not going to get us all focused, but I think it's important for business. What you're saying is stay on track. Here are the rules to get you on track and keep you successful and keep you moving ahead. It's not about who's right and who's wrong. What you're talking about is staying on focus. That's where I was coming from with that.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I agree with that.
Yeah, and I think one of the great rules to live by, and I've lived by this rule for many, many years now, is that a good leader knows when to follow and a good teacher knows when to be a student, and I change hats 4 or 5 times a week.
Yeah, you need to be in business and in life a chameleon, and it's all about the environment at a particular point in time, and you do what it takes to get the job done. And, you know, I have a pretty simple rule. I'll do anything as long as it's ethical and it's not harmful to anyone. And it's really part of what I call the mother rule. If you don't want your mother to know about that you did something, it means you probably shouldn't do it because it's bad.
You know, one of the big problems that I've run into over the years, I've done, you know, on and off, I'll do consulting. And I haven't for a while, but I remember going into business. And I would sit down there with the CEO, COO, CFO, whoever it was, and I would say, okay, your immediate subordinate, write down what you think that their job is. And then I would get the subordinate and I'd say, okay, write down what you think your job is and also write down what you think the CEO thinks your job is. And I'll tell you what, Michael, I can't tell you how many times
it
match.
Guaranteed.
Yeah.
Guaranteed. I think it gets down to also that I write about in the book, The Benevolent Dictator. Few people ever get out of bed in the morning and go to work and say, wow, I can't wait to get there so I can screw up. Never has happened to me in my life. What usually happens is people don't know where the finish line is, what's expected of them, and it doesn't happen by osmosis. As corny as it sounds, most people will do the right thing, as you said earlier, as long as it makes some sense and it's a decent thing to do, but you got to tell them what to do. Too many leaders assume people know, and that it doesn't work that way. Clarity is the secret, particularly, as I said earlier, you got to move so much faster today. As you mentioned, you can sit on the beach and do work with a BlackBerry. 20 years ago, 25 years ago, it took so long to get things done because information moved at a snail's pace. Today, it's measured in seconds at times, and you need to make sure people can go so far down the road because they're confused or don't understand the objective and do a lot of damage until you get them in the right direction.
Now, by the way, one of your talking points on the press release, and I think it is so critical for business if you want to stay in business, always look at a new idea through your customer's eyes.
Oh.
There was a rule. There was a rule, and the rule is never sell the way you buy. People buy for their reasons, not ours, and I can't tell you how many times that I have heard people present to themselves, sell to themselves, talk to themselves without the idea that somebody thought differently than they did.
I have a very simple premise on which I operate, and that is we need, my companies, the customer, much more than he or she will ever need us. So our job is to figure out what they're not getting and make sure we give it to them in an effective way. I get so aggravated in my businesses when people say, well, we're going to do this and that, and I always ask one simple question. Who cares? Does the customer care? Does it add something that they care about? I made a killing in the office supplies business simply because the traditional old office supply stores happened to be open when, where, and how the owners chose, and that was usually 9 o'clock to 5 o'clock at night. What we found out very quickly is business customers struggling to make it, and small business particularly, wanted to shop where they wanted to, and that meant 7 in the morning or 8 o'clock at night. It was like low-hanging fruit to be able to make those kinds of changes. And I think most businesses, the good ones don't, but a lot of too many businesses are too smug and think they are so much smarter than the customer. And that is a recipe. When I was in the venture capital business, when people would come in and try to pitch me for money and this or that, and they'd say, well, the customer won't get it, we can do this and that. It was a very short conversation and they would be out.
You know, you mentioned the word smug, which I think is very interesting. People going into business today, and especially today, we have more and more entrepreneurs out there because of what's going on in the outsourcing, et cetera. But the point here, the point here is this, that you start a business, find people. When you get to the point where you need to augment your skills, find people who are smarter than you are in that particular field. That smug, that ego-driven business, it costs more businesses.
You're right. I think most, and this is very interesting, most entrepreneurs tend to do the things they do best and don't want to let go. Smart entrepreneur takes the things that he or she does poorly and gives it away and to somebody else that's much better than they are. And more importantly, a good entrepreneur, the two rules I have for running a company, a CEO or the person leading it, has to do two things every day. Number one, they got to stir the pot because there's someone coming up behind them. They may not know it, and complacency will put you out of business. And the second important thing that they really have to do every single day is figure out how to do it better and find more efficient ways to deliver value to the consumer or their customer. It could be selling widgets or it could be selling office supplies or wellness products.
Now, by the way, the one thing that is so critical that you've addressed and you've done yourself, it's know when to bail.
Oh, yeah. I think one of the things I learned a long time ago, I'm a big baseball fan, and baseball game is 9 innings. So it doesn't matter what you do in the first inning or the second inning or the third inning. It's at the end of the day, do you win or lose? I think so many companies start out with really good ideas, and entrepreneurs particularly fall in love with their plan. Never fall in love with what you're planning to do. Fall in love with what you hope to deliver and what is the end result. Most startup companies fail because they get up in the morning, go to work, say, this is the plan, I pored over it, it's 50 pages, we're going to follow everything in it. Well, I got bad news for everybody. I've been more successful than the average bear, but most plans never work as planned. So in the book, The Benevolent Dictator, I talk about the importance of having plan A, B, and sometimes C. And as you just said, sometimes you could be going down a path and it's the old adage, your first loss is your best loss. Sometimes you got to pull the plug. Sometimes you have to stop, take a time out. But to blindly go down a path just because that's your plan, it's a guaranteed recipe for failure.
Now, by the way, the idea may be good. The product, the service, the cause, the concept, whatever it is, may be wonderful. And it could be the wrong mix. That's driving.
Well, there's so many. What's really interesting to me and hopefully to your listeners is there is not one element that will make or break you. It's usually a series of different things. And as you just said, everything could be right except one key element. And if you don't recognize it, you'll never get it. What I believe in is experimentation. I've used the term in the book, The Benevolent Dictator Laboratory, throughout. Because what we all do, same with your radio show, it's a laboratory. You may sit down after this interview and say, okay, I had this guy on, and I'll never have another office supply health guy on again because he did this or that. Or conversely, you'll pick up another idea. So you keep evolving, and evolution is the key to really success. I started with one store and got to 1,000 stores in a short period of time. I got the $3 billion, and I'm using the Royal I and the Royal We, but we got the $3 billion in sales in 7 years. Truthfully, when I started my plan, the original plan, I talk about it in the book, provided for 100 stores in 5 years, and I was close to 1,000 in 7 years. Because I read the fig leaves as I was going down the path, I learned as I went, and I seized the opportunity. Being an opportunist is not a pejorative. Being an opportunist is what good business people do. You seize the opportunity when you see a need for what you want to do.
And that's the one thing we still have in this country today. It's the freedom of choice, and choice allows you to have opportunity. And what you said about the moving along, working with it as it comes up, taking the opportunity and getting the best out of it and moving forward. 28 years ago, when I first sat down behind a microphone in Fairbanks, Alaska,
I've been there. Good for you.
Yeah. There is no way that you and I could have had this conversation today. 28 years later, with all the experience, the moving, the falling down, the whatever the case may be, allows you to be able to do what you do. It's taking the falling down, business especially. You've got to have that certain toughness inside, because you're going to fail in a few things. And if you fail,
if you take the best entrepreneur in the world, you pick Steve Jobs, anybody, yeah. If they have not failed, that tells me one thing. They're not doing enough, and they're not pushing hard enough. A good baseball player can make $10, $20 million a year if they bat .333. So that means almost six and a half times they don't do anything. Same thing in business. But the trick is you need to know when to pull the pin on the piece that doesn't work, change it, and then move on. And then conversely, when something is really working, most people get too scared, and they get into that mode, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. When it's starting to work, make it work better, because in this country, it's a wonderful country, you're doing something and it works, there'll be five other people behind you figuring out how to do a little bit better. I call it one step ahead of the sheriff. All it is continuing to innovate. Innovate doesn't mean build a rocket ship to the moon. Innovate to me means how to serve that customer and create delight exceeding expectations. Great thing for your listeners to know, whether they admit it or not, expectations in this country for good service at retail or business in life is really not that high. So to be astoundingly successful, how about being polite, understanding, not be afraid to tell your customer you're sorry when you do something wrong, and keep adding value, whatever it is.
Now, by the way, Michael Foyer, we're running out of time, but there's a quote that stays with me constantly, and it has to do with business, because we do fall down. We get up, we fall down, we get up again. But I think John Wayne had the greatest quote that there ever was, and he said, "Life is tough, but it's worse when you're stupid."
That's right. That is very, very true, and I think that's exactly right. And a little bit of humility, I have to tell you, and this sounds strange because I've been fairly successful, and I guess I've made those proverbial tens of millions of dollars. I'm probably more humble today, easier to access, if you want to call me, easier to do many things, because over the years I've learned that I've been very fortunate and that I have nothing to be smug about. I was just lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time, but hopefully smart enough to know I was being lucky, and that's the key.
Oh, you know, let's take it beyond luck for a moment. The I'll go to venture something, and somebody will look at me and they'll say, "Good luck." And inevitably, I'll smile and say, no, it's good skill. And everything that you're talking about.
I think you're right. Luck is a euphemism for another word. And it can be a combination of skill. But I will tell you this. You come to that fork in the road as a business operator, and you get into that old thing called analysis paralysis. Sometimes it does get down to you run a business with your head, your heart, and your gut. On a great day, all three work for you. On a bad day, one will get you through, and that one does come along with a little bit of luck. I'll take it every time. I'm not a superstitious person, but I got to tell you, I won't walk under ladders or black cats walking in front of me don't make me particularly happy. So luck isn't such a bad thing.
Well, and if you boil it all down, and we are running out of time, with it, it's the difference between intelligence and wisdom. Intelligence is academic. It allows you to analyze it until you're paralyzed, yada, yada. But at the same time, when you've been in business and you've fallen down and you've got back up again, the gift that you get is something called wisdom. And it's the wisdom that's going to cause you to move forward and get it done.
It's a bad visual, but okay. If I took off my shirt, you would see how smart I am by the scars on my back from the mistakes that I've made.
Hey, by the way, website we can find you at?
www.thebenevolentdictator.com, or you can buy the book at bookstores everywhere or at amazon.com.
Wonderful. Michael Foyer, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time.
My pleasure, and I enjoyed the time. Thank you, and thank your listeners.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, from now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
And let the magic angel create.
They would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms I can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking them in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Hey, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. He's back. Mayor Eisenstein. Mayor, how are you?
Oh, Michael, how are you? And I got special regards from you from Dr. Rima LeBeau, you know, who I was corresponding with. And she said, say hello to Michael for me.
Oh, I haven't talked to her for a good few years now. A wonderful woman.
And I, the reason is lots of background noise because I'm at an incredibly outstanding conference, Health Freedom Expo. It's here in Schaumburg, Illinois, at the Renaissance Hotel. And this is every quack possible, including myself, that's involved with healthcare. Everyone who wants less pharmaceuticals, less intervention in the healthcare system is here. And it's phenomenal. And I'm joking, you know, but at least the rest of the world thinks of us like that. And there's just anything you could think of here. You know, there's a lot of speakers, and of course, I'll give you a guess what I'm speaking on here.
No, well, wait, by the way, before you say it, and we'll never guess what it is, that for the life of me, I couldn't guess it. Yeah, I know. Well, there was a guest on during the week, and you know what she was talking about that was absolutely necessary in your nutritional program? Vitamin D3.
Vitamin D3. Yeah, let me tell you something. You know, but I'm speaking actually about HCG and weight loss, and of course, vitamin D, and more vitamin D. And I can't tell you, even in this really forward-thinking crowd, how little there still is an understanding of the importance of vitamin D. You know, it's still everyone's taking such small amounts, even though people understand it, are taking 800 units a day, 1,000 a day. They somehow, and then I had one woman who said to me that, you know, she's in the sun. She doesn't have to worry about vitamin D. Well, I said, when do you get out in the sun? Late in the afternoon. And I said, no, it's 10 to 2. And who's out? He said, I can't. I work. I said, that's right. You know, our jobs are incompatible with healthy vitamin D levels.
By the way, there's an interesting point. Let's go back to the HCG for a moment. I want to stay focused on that just for a bit. And I know you've lost way over 100. What is it, 130 pounds so far?
No, not that, but 115, you know.
The 15 pounds doesn't mean anything. Here's the point I want. Well, here's the point I want to make. The HCG. I have seen, I don't know how many ads come over the internet for HCG,
right,
and it's $300, $600, whatever the case may be. It's very expensive. But the point is they're allowing it to go over the internet. Now, my understanding, and stop me if I'm wrong with this, that if you're going to do that, if you're going to use that program, go to a medical doctor. Get it prescribed.
100%. Well, and I tell you why that's important. I mean, over the internet, much of what's being done is homeopathic HCG. And the homeopathic HCG, it'll work for some people, and the reason they can sell it because it's not by prescription. You know, what we're using is pharmaceutical HCG, which requires a physician, but you also want it to be monitored by a doctor who's enthusiastic about the program, who can help you, because it's more than just weight loss. You want to start looking at some of your diabetic values, your vitamin D levels, you know, and you want to put it together in a way that it's not only about weight loss. I mean, even though that's the most important component, you know, but you can't imagine how deficient so many people come are in vitamin D. And typically a doctor who's involved in this program, and we have now more than 50 doctors who are doing our program, you know, which is, you know, and they're all doing the same thing, measuring vitamin D levels, you know, and so it just all fits in together. I agree. I mean, you know, this is not like going to Jenny Craig or Weight Watchers. All those are calorie-restricted programs with no medical supervision. And I'm not knocking them, but I'm not very happy with what they're using, you know. You know, one of the biggest things that came out the last couple of weeks has been the plate. You know what the plate is, Michael?
No.
$2 million worth of advertising to change the food pyramid from a pyramid to a plate, and I mean, how incredibly crazy is this? And they've the plate now. So all it does is take what they put in the pyramid. 35 to 40% of your calories, they should say, come from carbohydrates. Now that's fine if you're an elephant or you're a giraffe, you know. But as humans, we can't eat 35 to 40% of our calories from carbohydrates. You know, it for some reason, the food industry, which is maybe more sinister than even the pharmaceutical industry, wants us to be fat. You know, they know that with this amount of carbohydrate, the average person will end up being 30, 40, 50 pounds overweight. You know, we've talked about this before, but now they're spending millions of dollars, and all they do is change the words. You know, it reminds me of my late professor, Dr. Mendelsohn, said, words are what are used as political tools. So when marijuana was used in the ghettos, it was called weed. But then he said when it moved into the middle class, they called it grass. You know? He said, then it became more, because grass is more acceptable than weed, you know.
Words are critically important. No question about it, but I want to jump in with this because I think it's critically important with what you're doing and the gathering that you're at right now. There are sources, whether it's the pharmaceutical industry or whether it be agency within the government, et cetera, that will try to control the strength of the supplements that we're taking today.
You are not kidding. Let me tell you something, how on point you are. The owner of Zicam, that's a company that put out a natural product with zinc, you know, and what they did was they arrested him for false advertising, for advertising that it would cure flu and colds. Now, let me tell you something. The last time I saw it, no zinc product ever harmed anyone, but all the drugs that are on the market are so harmful, and they're saying that as a food supplement, they don't have a right to put any medicinal claims, even if the scientific literature says that it has those, it could do that, because it's a food supplement.
Then the problem with this is that food supplements are extremely necessary. Let's take your average food, whatever that may be, from the time that it gets processed or brought out of the ground and it's shipped to you and it goes to the store. By the time you get it on your plate, it could be 3 to 4 weeks. Now, if you have a digestive problem, that's even going to be worse. So the nutrients, you lose a great percentage of the nutrients before it hits your plate. Then when you eat it, you'll lose a great percentage if your digestive system isn't working properly. So you've got to have the supplements to augment what you're missing through your food, because if you don't have it, there's going to be some problems. And I think one of the biggest problems is when somebody starts to say the word cure. You and I have talked about this I don't know how many times. Things don't cure things. Your immune system cures it, and it's housed within inside of you. Everything else out there shores it up and helps it and moves it along its way. So we don't cure things. We shore up that immune system.
Oh, let me tell you, it's so on point. And there's no question about our food is enzyme depleted, it's vitamin depleted, you know, and maybe it's necessary, to an extent, because when you mass produce things, you want to make sure that people don't get sick from it. Obviously, the ideal is to have your own little plot of land to grow your own food. I mean, unfortunately, it's not realistic to a large extent. But you're right, and when you're eating depleted food, in fact, one of the things that's interesting is our food is massively depleted of selenium, and selenium is another one of these trace minerals which have been shown to have so much benefit. Times past, you never have to think about. No one ever took selenium. What do you have to take selenium for? You know, it's in the food. But you're right. You look in the food, and it's just completely depleted. The supplements are extremely important. But I think what's important, they're supplements. And of course, the drug industry doesn't want you to take supplements because they know that people who take supplements are less likely to take pharmaceuticals.
Yeah. Now, by the way, when we're really dealing with what goes on, we have to go all the way back, because if you talk to Rima and you talk to her about Codex Alimentarius, you're going to find out, and I'm not sure if you're aware of what that is, but way back in 1962, the Trade Commission, it was by the UN. Okay, now they've got it back again, and they're trying to control the international trade of food. And its initial intentions may have been altruistic, there's no question about it, but it's been taken over by corporate interest, pharmaceutical,
exactly.
Pesticide, biotechnology, chemical industries. That's what you're dealing with.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's why you got to watch movies like Food, Inc. It's frightening. You watch these type of movies, you say, my God, you're afraid to eat afterwards, you know. But I can tell you one thing. The Lord has made us pretty resilient. And what I find impressive, in spite of severe vitamin D deficiency, in spite of mineral deficiency, we still do pretty good. But the trouble is, pretty good isn't good enough. You know, I think that's the – and look, we turned into a country of extremely overweight, unhealthy individuals. By the time you reach 60, the average American is taking 10 different pharmaceuticals.
Yeah. By the way, Mayor, you know what this is all part of? If you want to title it, it's called the sickness industry.
And then absolutely right. Absolutely right. This is not the health industry. No, there's no doubt about it. I mean, and that's why, you know, I was reading about the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center was talking about vitamin D as a treatment for breast cancer and colon cancer and prostate cancer. It's important. The higher the vitamin D level, the less problem you have. And they were recommending 800 units of vitamin D. Are they that stupid to believe you need some that little? You know, I see. Unfortunately, these big institutions only thrive if there's cancer. So their goal is to increase the cancer rate, not to lower the cancer rate. And it sounds almost sinister, but if God forbid or heaven forbid or cancer went away, they're out of business. American Heart Association, they're into producing heart disease. That's their goal.
Absolutely. They make money. And if you look at it, look at the $800, $900 million that was congressional lobbying that goes on every year by Big Pharma. They're paying off they're paying off our elected officials to get what they want to get. And if we're not very careful, they're going to get what they want to get, and you're going to have a lot of sick people, and it's going to go back to years ago when we had Soylent Green.
Right. Oh, my God. You and I are old enough to remember that movie with Charlton Heston.
Yeah. Now, wait. You know, some of us are old enough. I don't think I am.
No, I don't think you're old enough. You saw it on Netflix.
My grandfather told me about it. No, but when it really comes down to it, now you're right. I saw the movie two or three times. But the point of contention is that it's moving in a particular direction. If you don't have people like yourself, like Rima LeBeau, like the different organizations, and the one especially that you're at in Schaumburg right now, we will be in big trouble. And the messages are so confused. I'm going to repeat this night after night after night, that with these confused messages, and it's so hard to navigate through what's real, apathy sets in. And when apathy sets in, they take over.
Let me tell you, it's very inexpensive. It's $15 a day, and there's great speakers here, as well as maybe 200 exhibits. And anyone who's in the Chicagoland area, stop in. It's the Renaissance Hotel in Schaumburg. It'll be you'll have a good time. I guarantee you. And, of course, if you come, you'll stop and you'll see me.
And by the way, at the $15, will that take payments over like 18 months?
They will take even 2 years of payments. If you don't have $15, I'll sneak someone in.
Thanks. That's like the old days in the drive-ins. I know most people won't remember this. You got to
Oh, my God. You're not kidding. You jumped
in the trunk.
Yeah, you know what? I love it. I absolutely love it. Just awesome. Let me tell you something. But the bottom line is, I really do believe that this still is the greatest country in the world, and will be, continue to be the greatest country in the world. And we will... and all this type of stuff, what we're talking about, there's, my dad used to say about America, he said, they put up with it, and one day they said, that's it, enough, and it's kind of like the Berlin Wall. It didn't come down over a period of time. It came down overnight after years of thinking about it. I'm using that just as an example. I think the same thing is going to happen here with the supplement industry, with all of a sudden everyone's saying, enough is enough. We're no longer going to be doing this. I think that's what's going to happen.
Mayor, listen, have fun there, and I'm sorry
Thank
I can't
you.
Get down there. But I always appreciate when you're on, and we're gonna. Is it going to be going on next week?
I enjoy it. I absolutely enjoy it. Always enjoy it. It's the highlight of my beginning of the weekend.
Oh, good. Take some more Prozac. You'll be fine.
Let me tell you something. That's one thing I don't do at all. I've never had trouble with that. I'm never. I think I really do value being alive. And really this losing of over 100 pounds has really given me a renewed vigor in life, I'm thrilled about it,
Mayor, people who take Prozac can't deal with life, and they are not happy with life. Somebody once said to me, what are you going to do when you retire? I said, what do you mean retire? I don't work.
Thank you. Well, let me tell you, I've met so many patients who I've taken care of over the years, who haven't vaccinated their children, it's like, thank you. No, let me tell you something. That's why our business is dying out, because we've got 40,000 unvaccinated children that don't get sick, which is fine. Awesome. Thank you. I'm on the radio here in Milwaukee, Michael, thank you so much.
Your website.
www.homefirst.com. That's HOMEFIRST.com. And if anyone is in the Chicagoland area, come see me at the Renaissance Hotel in Schaumburg. God bless. Have a wonderful weekend.
See you next week.
Thank you. Be well.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are. I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true.
and cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you, and I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do, say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do, say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah!
Rick Wimberly with us. He's the author of Seven Myths of Selling to the Government, Secrets for Success in Government Sales Today. He's established himself as a successful professional, subject matter expert, particularly in the areas of public safety, emergency notification, homeland security, communications, and government information technology. He served in leadership roles, pioneering two of the most accepted public safety products in the last 15 years. He's a leader in an international organization that promotes creative problem solving and has been instrumental in the turnaround of several companies. He's also a former broadcaster, Communication Solutions. Wimberly introduced the to Department of Homeland Security, Federal Emergency Management Agency, Centers for Disease Control, Federal Bureau of Investigation have become agency standards. And let us say, Rick, hi, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. I love your music, by the way.
Oh, thank you. No, it's great stuff. It's called Get in the Mood. If you're going to do an interview, you might as well have fun while you're doing it.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate hearing that.
No, I hear you. Hey, Rick, let me ask you this. The myths of selling to the government. Selling to the government is something that you just don't walk in and do. There's a structure. There's a strategy to do it. And it's very confusing today. And if you don't have the wherewithal, you're not going to get anywhere.
Well, I think that is an absolute fact. First of all, you have to look at what makes government selling or selling to government different from commercial markets. And the mere size certainly is one of the things that sets it apart. I mean, the government buys over $5 trillion with a T, dollars in products and services at the local and state federal levels every year. They buy everything, and so if you're selling it, chances are good that someone in the government is buying it. However, it's a complex environment to work through. You've got to handle a maze to make a government sale, and the maze is because of not only rules and regulations, but other things that make it different.
Does it really come down to, and this is a question, Rick, does it really come down to who you know? And it doesn't necessarily mean what you have to offer. It's who you know to open the door. Otherwise, there's no chance of getting in there, even if you had the greatest product or service in the world.
Well, to some extent, that may be true, but it's a little bit different than knowing people in your golf club who buy things in the government and having them give you an advantage. One of the keys is you've got to establish yourself, build a personal brand within government as someone who can be trusted to help deliver value. So relationships are without a doubt extremely important, but they're not the types of relationships that you make in your social life.
One of the things I think is very important, one of the myths and facts that you deal with, that marketing and sales are on the same page as the myth, the fact they're not even on the same planet, and that is so true. When we talk about sales today, to define it, you've got a completely different, the consumer out there, even if you're not dealing with the government, there is a whole different world out there. There was a time that if you and I wanted to buy a car, we'd go to the car lot, negotiate the deal, they'd find out what your objections were, and how to, you know, and it'd get sold. That doesn't work today. I can sit here on my computer. I did it the other day. I clicked a button and I went to a place called CarMax. CarMax has got 130,000 cars, new and used, all over the country. We honed into a particular lot. We honed into a particular car. We honed into, this is what the salesperson, we honed into the price. And I didn't do it at the time, but I could have negotiated it right then and there. Never left the house, got to Carfax, and there's nothing I don't know anymore. So to deal with the consumer, the e-consumer now, is a completely different, you're in a completely different world. And if you don't know what you're doing, and I see that based on what you've got here, you've got it spot on. But if you don't know what you're doing, you're going to be in big trouble out there.
Yes, I think, the rules are certainly different for dealing with government. But I can't say that the government buying practices are up to the speed that consumer buying practices are. A lot of what you deal with are things that have been ingrained into a labyrinth of a system over years and years and years. So despite efforts to reform the process, you're still dealing with the same type of environment as people were dealing with a number of years ago.
Now, if I'm dealing with the government, I'm probably going to be one of many, many people making a presentation for a similar end result, whatever that might be. So what do I do to distinguish myself from everybody else that is making that presentation? What do I have to do to be different, to be branded, to be that one that they look at as opposed to the other ones?
Well, the first thing you have to do is start well before the presentation. By the time you get to a presentation, chances are good that the preferences are made, so or at least have been established to some degree. So what you have to begin with is by building that relationship that comes through doing things such as providing good content to the people who you'll be selling to. Nothing is purchased in the government without someone somewhere building a huge file that contains a lot of paperwork that is evidence that the taxpayer money is being spent wisely. So if you can be the person who helps in that investigative process, who helps provide information that will help them make good decisions, then you're a step ahead of the game when you get into a presentation. When you get into a presentation, though, it will not make or break a sale. Well, let me say this: it may break one, but it won't make a sale. One of the things that we've had the opportunity to do in our consulting practice is be on both sides of the table. Certainly, we have made hundreds and hundreds of presentations to government buyers. But we've also had a chance to sit on the other side where we were engaged to help government make buying decisions. And what is interesting is the lack of power that a presentation does contribute to a buying decision. However, in our opinion, most people do presentations wrong anyway. They have a tendency to start with, here's how great our company is, here's what our features and our functionality is, do you have any questions, and here's how much it costs. Where we're big believers in that you structure your presentation similar to the way that a rock concert would be structured, where you build momentum, then maybe you back off a little bit, and then then there's got to be a grand finale. Never put your pricing at the end. That should be somewhere in the middle. And always put yourself in a situation where you can do a good bit of listening during the presentation, where you are not showing up and as we say, throwing up, where you are really reflecting what it is that they want to and need to hear, which is something that you can certainly work into your presentation, but that you have to work toward in advance as well.
Now, by the way, one of the things that I've learned over years is that you do your takeaway right up front, and then the rest of the presentation is going to be having your audience, one person, 10,000, whatever it is, anticipate how they're going to get to that solution that you're there offering. And I really believe what you just said about, you know, it's about you and your company, et cetera, when you're doing a presentation. Your audience will never buy product. They'll never buy you. They won't buy me. They'll buy what that product, what it can do for them and what you're offering. And more importantly, it's not the product itself. It's the end result of the product. The people that you're trying to communicate with, sell to, reach to, teach, whatever the reason, they don't care about you. They don't care about what you have to offer until how you have, they know how what you have can benefit them. They can recognize a perceived value inside of your message. And I think in government especially, there are variables, there are factors that aren't there when you're dealing with corporations. You said it early on. I'm going to make sure that all that paperwork is there to make sure the money went into the right place and it was spent the right way, because one way or the other, it's going to get investigated down the line if you've got, you know, one side of the aisle going after the other side of the aisle. So all of those things are incorporated into the sale, and I believe a lot of people make a mistake, and you just said it, when they start out about, we're this, we're good there, nobody cares.
Yeah, in all sales, but it's particularly important in government, that you got to find out where the pain is. And you've got to figure out, number one, if you can help relieve that pain, and number two, how you can properly present your case that you can relieve the pain. But if you can't find the pain, you can't make the sale to the government. In fact, one of the myths in the book is always go to the top. And I'm not sure that works particularly well in some commercial sales, but it's something a lot of sales managers preach, but it just doesn't work. The top may not be where the pain is, and I found myself one day sitting in a one-on-one meeting with a cabinet secretary, and he was very enthusiastic about what I was talking to him about, and gave a just all the buying signs, and I left the meeting thinking, yeah, man, this sale is going to happen. And that was about 10 years ago, and that sale still hasn't happened. So what the failure was is I didn't get at the right people in the organization who my solution could help the most.
Now, by the way, you said a very magic word there. And then the magic word was solution, because the only thing anybody ever sells, and it's taken me, I've been in communication close to, I'm going to tell you 40 years, but don't tell anybody. That's our secret, okay? but I've
Your
been
secret's
in communication.
Safe with me. I've got a very similar secret.
Oh, thank you. I feel better now. But the only thing that you're selling one thing and one thing only. You're selling a solution to a problem or a possibility of gaining something you want and you didn't know how to get it. Because a solution or a resolve to their problems, there's your pain, is the only thing that people are going to buy, whether it's government or whether it's somebody buying a used car. It is all the same thing. You've got to offer the solution to the problem and see beyond what that is, and the possibility of, again, gaining what you want, and quote-unquote, how are you going to feel about it after you get it? And that works in government, too, because if you negotiate with somebody in the government, I don't care if you're going to spend $10 trillion or $250, in the end result, when that person or that organization or that committee within have bought, what they're going to end up with is some emotional satisfaction, knowing that they covered their rear ends, they're going to get what they want to get, and they're secure because nobody's going to infiltrate and cause it to be a negative.
You're right on the money, Michael. I think that, as a matter of fact, one of the myths that we mentioned in the book is RFPs, requests for proposals, bids, et cetera, drive government business. Because there is so much bureaucracy that you have to go through, and because there is a process that has been established and has evolved over years that is designed to make sure that taxpayer money is spent properly, people sometimes forget that it is people who you're selling to in the government. People make buying decisions also in the government.
Sure. No, I mean, no question about it. And it's the decision. It's in the decision that people are frightened to death to make that decision. I think in government more than anything else, Rick, they're afraid to make that decision because what could the consequences be?
Well, one of the things that we try to help people understand, particularly if they are new to selling to the government space, is to develop an understanding of who these people are who are buying. And you hit on something that is just absolutely on the money. These are not big risk takers. The system does not encourage risk. And it's in part because if they make a mistake, they don't make up for it the next quarter like you can in the commercial space. People remember the mistakes. They are not easy to overcome. And, you know, if they make a serious enough mistake, somebody could get hurt. So they're very, very cautious, which is one of the reasons that it's so important to establish the right type of relationship with government buyers, because they want to buy from people and companies who they feel they can trust they can trust with their careers, quite frankly, because they don't want to make a mistake. I also, you know, like to tell people that if you're one who has the opinion that that government employees tend to be slackers, then, you know, get over that, because granted, there may be some in the government, but the people who are in a position to buy in government are the movers and shakers, and they may not be the boss, but they are movers and shakers. Their peers will make sure they're not in a position to buy if they're not high quality people.
No question about it. Rick, we're starting to run out of time. Website, please, we can find you at.
Okay, our website is, the name of the company is Government Selling Solutions. So our website is www, and pardon me for stumbling over this, I have to look it up, www.govselling.com, www.govselling.com.
Okay, here's the deal. You don't tell anybody how long I've been in communication, and I'll never tell anybody you had to look that up.
Thanks. I appreciate that. You're a kind man.
Hey, thank you so much for being here, and I appreciate your time. And we can get the book on the website, right?
Yes, you can. It's on Amazon.
Dynamite. Hey, Rick, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
No, so thank you. This has been a pleasure. Thanks, Michael. I like the way you think.
Good night.
Good night.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star, brave and faithful and true, and cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm all of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. We have to do it slowly. We're going to do a little different mood here. I like this better.
Once upon a time, a girl with moonlight in her eyes.
Nancy Kerner with us. She's an author, an inspirational speaker, a teacher, an intuitive, an alchemist, a wife, a mother, and the founder of Vision Dancer Productions, which hosts international women's retreats and events in Washington, Canada, and Hawaii. Nancy inspires women to join hands with women in their neighborhoods who are creating passionate possibilities while living their dreams in fun, creative, and sexy relationships. Her book is The Power of Sexy Relationships, How to Live Your Passions and Embrace Your Purpose. And let's say, Nancy, hi. Welcome to the show.
Aloha, Michael. It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, aloha to you, too. I by the way, people, they live lives and they forgot how to dream anymore. They forgot how to be in a relationship and even to look forward to what is a relationship. Nancy, let me ask you this. In all of your experience and everything that you've done and the things that you do, how can you define a relationship today? What is a relationship?
Well, my definition is a relationship is the ability to connect with one person to another from your heart. And, of course, that's like the foundation and the core, and then everything else is around it, learning the language of that connection, whether it's through intuition or words or your vibration or energy, you know, because 95% of our relationship is happening on the unseen level. So it's not everything that we see in front of us and who we see in front of us, but how they feel to us in our bodies.
See, Nancy, the reason for the question was this. We, you know, through the culture, through the society, things change so drastically, and you see all of these divorces, 55% of the people who get married first time divorce and second time and third time and whatever the case may be. And I really look around, I really take a look around and think, do people really know what a relationship is anymore? And do they really know how to deal in one? We've got so many people that are so self-involved and frightened to death to be hurt that they're afraid to take that step. How do you move through that? How do you get them to open the door and walk through?
Well, I agree with you. I think the high divorce rate is a symptom of humanity, and that what we're doing is we're creating a new foundation to connect and relate to one another so that the ripple effect can help with the world events, what's going on the bigger level. And our relationships are the foundation for the evolution of our humanity. So for me, it begins at home, learning and teaching other women what to look for in their relationship, because oftentimes what is missing is the breakdown of communication. When I talk to women, they say, we don't have any intimacy. Well, do you know what intimacy is? No, I don't. Well, then how can you have it if you don't know what it is? And if there's a lot of drugs and alcohol in your background or history and that you've come up in dysfunctional families, that's all that people know. So what I do is that I help them to get clear about the distinction of if they're in a healthy relationship, if they're in a healthy body, mind, and spirit, because you need that in order to have a healthy relationship, you know, then we can approach the relationship after we deal with, you know, what's underneath the surface. Most people today are looking at the superficial and not dealing with the core of what's going on inside. So we up the roots and take a look at, you know, the mental health and well-being, spiritual health and well-being. And we don't preach to anybody on any kind of dogma. Everybody is free to choose their higher power or higher calling or to not if they don't want to. But if they miss this connection of relationship, they're missing humanity. They're missing a huge vital component, which is to love. To love ourselves and to love one another.
You have to be able to recognize it before you can do it. And I think one of the very simple things that you can do, which people do not do, it's this. You and I meet and we decide we like each other. So you know what the first thing I'm going to ask you is, how do you receive love? We don't ask that. We take it for granted that we know how the other person receives love. And here's the example. Let's say all of my life I was taught that a wink, a look, a tone of voice, an expression means I love you. Let's say for you, it was hypothetically that if you buy you something, that means I love you. So we meet, we get together, we move in together, everything's fine. 2 years later, I walk in and you're all packed up. And I said, well, what's going on here? She said, you say, I'm leaving. Why are you leaving? Well, you don't love me. What do you mean I don't love me? You never tell me. I have never said it in a way that you have learned to relate to it. We don't ask those simple questions. And that in and of itself, I think, would be the door to open to humanity, because everything you said about the emotional connection, the rest of it is spot on. But you've got to be able to recognize the doorway to get there.
Yeah, it's interesting. The doors that open the conversation, like what you and I are having right now, are varied in how women come to me and ask me, you know, what do you do? How do you do it? I will find the most surprising conversations of talking about what you're speaking to, the languages of love, and how do we show love, how do we give it and receive it. But what I find at the core is a real need for self-worth and self-love, and people think that that might be egotistical, but actually, until we can love ourselves fully and conditionally 100%, how can we extend that love out? And how can we learn the language of love and how other people receive it and give it? So what we find is that when women come together and they start speaking about relationships, not in the, he's a jerk, although they might say that, when they start kind of unloading and venting what the problem is, they feel better afterwards just by speaking it, because it releases serotonin within the brain and in also the gut. There's 95% of the serotonin released in the lower intestines, which gives that antidepressant feeling of feeling good. So, you know, just by women coming together and connecting, engaging in conversation helps them to feel good. And we watch women get off of antidepressants and to turn their relationships around once they come into a community, an event, a retreat that we host. Or by reading this book, my hope is that it'll be in the hands of more women, and they'll see that they are not alone, they're not terminally unique, and that every human being has relationship issues. Even our famous Dr. Phil and his wife have an occasional relationship issue, because women are constantly changing emotionally, hormonally, and men are too. But it's nice to have women who can understand and relate to the hormonal side, and we can walk women through that so they can get in touch with what's underneath and their intuition, so they can be a much happier and a healthy, sexy relationship for the long term.
Now, by the way, I can only give to you what I have myself. If I don't love me, and I'm paraphrasing what you're saying, if I don't love me, there's no way I can love you. If I don't respect me, there's no way I can respect you. And what I have found over the years, and it's very simple, but I found over the years, Nancy, that people who like themselves like other people who like themselves. People who don't like themselves will migrate to people who don't like themselves. And if you're in a room and if there's somebody giving you that look that, you know, that you know that they don't like you, and you happen to like yourself, you know they don't like themselves. It's a very great, it's a good indicator, and it's a great symbol, or a signal, not a symbol. So if you like yourself, if you can get to that, and I think one of the basic ways to get there, very important, it's critical, is that be your own perfection and don't be somebody else's perfection. I can never, ever, never, ever be the first best Nancy Kerner. My best bet is I can be the second best you, but I can always be the first best me. And the biggest problem that we have, and I think the women who probably come to the workshop, same, trying to live up to somebody else's expectation and standards. It doesn't work. It will never work. It's not going to happen.
Well said, and that's one of the cords that women cut constantly in conversations and circles and events, is cutting the cords of what they think that other people expect them to do and be in life. And a lot of it starts from childhood, and most people don't want to go back and look at childhood, but, you know, it's more about empowering ourselves, taking our power back to look at where we picked up beliefs, patterns and behaviors along the way, so that we can identify them and say, whose belief is that? Where did I get that? Where did I learn that? And then also to make the distinction of whether being a powerful person, taking your power back, is a healthy thing for you to do or not. Because what's the opposite of being in your power is being a victim. So we're constantly teaching women how to dream again and step out of that victim place and take their power back. And most often, they can turn their relationships around when they're living in their power.
No, you just triggered something in me. I remember a long time ago, I had learned this. Can't remember the when or the where of it, but I remember that it stayed there. There are people who failure is success. The only way I get attention is if I'm failing and I can be complaining about it, etc. And the key here is this. You and I meet, we get into a relationship, and it starts to go good, and then I start to accuse you of things, I start to make it bad, the relationship is doing all the things that everybody complains about in a relationship. It has nothing to do with you, it has to do with me proving I'm right, that I don't like myself, and if you're going to be good for me, I'm going to do everything I can unconsciously to drive you away. The problem is the person on the other side of that takes it on as if it's them, think they have a problem, and they're working on something that doesn't exist, and they never get an answer.
Well said. You are just full of wisdom and knowledge, Michael. I like talking to people who like to talk about relationships. Well, the thing about making mistakes, what we talk about is, you know, we say when somebody makes a mistake, you know what we tell them? We say, you're so sexy. And the reason we do that is because we want people to make mistakes. We want them to see that that's part of growing and evolving into a better human being. And when we're humble, when we're experiencing humility, that just simply means we're being teachable. We're teachable. And in the headline news now, we're seeing a lot of popular people who are, you know, having their egos burst open in front of the world to see. And that's very humiliating. And hopefully, you know, what we can all learn is that we're no different than them. They're just acting it out on the bigger stage. So what I encourage people to do, because I see this a lot, is have women find mentors, and men too, to find good mentors and find relationships that you would like to emanate more of the qualities, not to be like them, but to see the qualities that they're exhibiting in their life.
Let me give you my definition of a strong woman. But before I do, let me ask you to define what a strong woman is.
Well, I like using the word powerful woman, because a powerful woman is a woman who's able to honor her voice, honor her body's intuition, and to make choices that are going to be in the benefit of her living in her highest purpose. So a powerful woman knows her purpose. She knows where she's going every day when she gets up. And at the same time, she lives in the flow and the grace and the mystery of life at the same time. So she's not controlling. So that's what I call a powerful woman. I'd love to hear your definition, though, of a strong woman.
Okay, absolutely. And I'll give you my definition of what a strong, powerful woman is. Let me see. I got to figure out how to word this so I don't. Okay, we'll use the word butthead, because that's not anything that you can't say. A powerful woman is if you walk up and you look at her in the eyes and say, you're a real butthead, and she looks back at you and say, yeah, and I'm good at it too.
I love that. one of my mentors said, you can walk up to a woman and look in her eyes and see if her heart is open or closed just by feeling her.
Yeah, and the whole thing, the power there is this, that it's not to be intimidated or not to be intimidated. They know who they are, and it doesn't matter what you say. It's not going to change anything.
That's right. And it's a lot more difficult for two very powerful people to maintain a long-term relationship, because they both have their purpose and they're both going after things that they want in life. But what we're seeing is if they have the right tools, two powerful people who know who they are and have big purposes can live together for the long term. We have women 39 years, 40 years marriage, and they're the sexiest women I know, and they're the teachers in our communities, and they're the role models for the women to learn from. And so what we've come together to do is to spread the word. Our vision is to reach 4 million women around the world to help them to take their power back and to be able to speak their voice without having to cut somebody off at the knees. But if they need to, they sure know how to stand in their power and say, stand back, you know?
Sure. No, I mean, no question about it. And but that's the whole point. A powerful person will draw another powerful person. A weak person will draw another weak person, and they get to act it all out together. And the problem, I think, is, and I'm going to say problem, is why do you have to act out anything in the first place? You and I, we've met three times already. This is good. You and I meet, and we decide that we like each other. Well, I'm not going to show you who I am. I'm going to show you who I think that you want me to be to make sure that I'm attractive to you. So then we meet, we get into a relationship, we're comfortable, I start to become Michael, and you say to me, well, who are you? You've changed since we first met. I didn't change. I am who I am, but who I am is starting to come out now, and that's not who you got into a relationship with. That's a problem. You get into somebody's face and you say, this is who I am. And if they don't like it, then get out of it now, because when if you get into it and you spend time, it's going to be a disaster down the road.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes we suggest that women really take a look in their heart and find out if this relationship is going to be the betterment for their health. We see a lot of women taking on disease in the body, around the breasts and in the ovaries and lower intestinal tract, because they hold the energy of the relationship so tight when they actually really need to let go of it. And so we ask women, are you addicted to your commitments or committed to your addictions? And when I say that, I'm referencing relationship addictions. We become addicts just, you know, waiting for the next fix, waiting to see him or to call him. And when women do that, you know, I invite them to take a look at the love and cuddle drug when they have sex before getting to know who the man is, and whether they can trust him or not. They often jump in the bed, and when they have sex, oxytocin, the bonding hormone, is released, and it's sex before trust, and it's a dangerous game, because then they can't stop obsessing about him. But actually what they are is they're addicted to the hormone that happened to be triggered as a result of the sex. So we ask women to really interview a guy good first.
Yeah, and then realistically, if you want to know what turns you on when you've got the oxytocin going and the dopamine and the endorphins and the rest of it, you look in the mirror and say, it's you that turns you on. And they just happen to be there. That's realistically what it is. And it's like this, you know, if you're married, and, you know, the question would be rhetorical. Did you marry your husband or did you marry how he made you feel? If 10 guys would have been standing there and you looked at him, he was the one who made you feel whatever that was. So in essence, it's not him. It's what he's going to do for you, how he's going to make you feel, how you're going to experience it. And that's really what the key is. But is everything that you're saying, I'm giving you the but here, which negates anything that came before it.
Right.
But if all of the things that you're saying come into play, I don't care how turned on you are, it's not going to work.
Yeah,
different bodies.
Definitely need to have real intimacy with somebody where you can really look into each other's heart and open up to being vulnerable. And that's hard, because that means the ego has to be disengaged and go to sleep for a little bit and lower the defenses that, you know, people walk around with in their day-to-day life. And really find out, you know, is this person going to support me to be the best that I can today? And that's what we help women do. That's why we tap into our creativity and our intuition, and we create events. And that's our purpose. We're constantly creating beauty in these events so that women can come in and bask in that beauty, which we feel is quite unique, and we haven't seen it anywhere else.
Okay, here it comes. We've got about a minute before we're done. Radio Susie's over there on the other side of the desk. She's looking at me and she says, you're going to do it? And I said, yes, I'm going to do it. Here we go. Nancy, ask me if I'm good looking. Go ahead.
Are you good looking, Michael?
Funny you should ask that. Absolutely. And if you don't think so, somebody else will.
I think you're good looking. I saw your picture on the website.
Oh, thank you, darling. But do you hear what I'm saying? Not necessarily Nancy, but if you don't think so, somebody else will. If I had the ability to have 5 women standing in front of me right now, and I could get behind each one and look through their eyes to see me, I would see 5 different Michaels. One or two of them, or one of them would be great looking. Somebody, the other one may be horrible looking. I can't change myself for everybody who looks at me. And those people who look at me and think I'm good looking, I'm going to be good looking to. Those people who look at me and think I'm not going to be. And there's nothing you can do about it. That's why you can't please everybody. Just be the best you, whoever you are. And if you do it that way, that person that thinks you're good looking and thinks you're the most wonderful person in the world will show up. Or you'll recognize
them. My husband is the sexiest man on earth, but he's probably only the sexiest man on earth to me.
And who cares? You get that? Who cares?
That's right. Well, to me, let's take it deeper. Forget about the looks. What's in your heart? That's what I want to know.
Because I can overlook looks.
I can overlook body types. I want to know who do you love? What turns you on, you know, in terms of your life purpose? That's to me, that's sexy.
By the way, I think Lady Gaga is very plain looking, and I don't like the way she looks at all. And there are people who think she's absolutely gorgeous. I think she's ugly.
I don't don't know if I've ever seen her outside of makeup and costume, so I couldn't tell.
That's the point. No, that's the point. What I see, I don't like. That doesn't mean that anybody else should dislike her or like her. That's not where I'm at with that. But it's that. That's the point. Beauty is in the eyes of the beholder.
Yes, it is. You're so right.
Okay. We're starting to run out of time. Can we get the website you're at so we can find you?
Yes. As the Dalai Lama says, women are the future of Western society. Please go to my website if you'd like more information at nancykerner.com. And we have a bunch of wonderful information on there and a retreat called the Ultimate Powerful Woman Retreat happening in October in British Columbia.
Wonderful. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I've appreciated your time.
Thank you. You've been a pleasure to dance with, Michael.
Oh, thank you. Good night.
Good night.
Off comes the clown's disguise. The curtain's fallen. The music softly dies. But I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door, as they say in this biz, that's all there is, there isn't any more.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap. See you Monday.
And as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger out.